Hello.
And welcome to a bonus episode of Dragons Made Me Do It, one of potentially many podcasts about Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern series, but the only one by us.
I'm Tequila Mockingbird.
And I'm Shay.
And today we're talking about the short story, The Girl Who Heard Dragons, originally published in 1986. I read it as part of a collection with the same title of other McCaffrey short stories, but it was also published in A Gift of Dragons.
Yeah, in 2003, so the same year as the last book that McCaffrey wrote by herself.
Got it.
So The Girl Who Heard Dragons is the story of Aramina, who is a young girl of somewhat indeterminate age, but probably early teens, mid-teens, I would say, who has the ability to hear all dragons. Her family was kicked out of their hold, or rather, fled from their hold in order to avoid being either murdered or, in her mother's case, taken as a concubine by Fax, the conqueror whose demise Lessa arranged at the beginning of Dragonflight. They have been, for the past long time...
Her entire life, I think.
They have been living holdless, or rather, they have been living on the generosity of a succession of holders because her father is a very talented joiner, carpenter. But Aramina's ability to hear all dragons has recently come to the attention of Thella, who describes herself as the Lady Holdless, who is attempting to unite a group of Holdless behind her in order to challenge the established political authorities on the planet. And she believes that Aramina's ability to hear dragons would be very useful because it would let her better evade the notice of the Weirs, who are assisting the Lord Holders who are trying to catch her. Aramina and her family do not want her to be pressed into the service of the Lady Holdless, so they flee again, and due to some circumstances, they end up stuck in the woods as Thread is incoming, and Aramina, for the first time, actively reaches out to one of the dragons that she has been listening in on, and calls for help, and Kavan, who we met in a previous bonus episode's short story, The Smallest Dragon Boy, comes to rescue her and her family, and they save Aramina from being kidnapped by Thella. And then the story ends with Falar and Lessa telling Aramina that she is going to be taken to the Weir.
So Aramina is born on their way through the mountains of Fort. I think that does add an interesting element because she's never been to Ruatha. She's never been to their home. She is only, and same with both of her younger siblings, known a nomadic life on the road.
Yeah, but her parents are attempting to get home and at the end are essentially guaranteed by Lessa in particular that they will find a place at Ruatha if they want it, or alternately are offered a place at Limos Hold, which is the area that they are in at that point.
And I think it is very interesting that both of her parents think of themselves as displaced smallholders, not as holdless people.
Yeah.
Because you see in the narrative a lot of disdain for holdless people. The quote that I wrote down is, having no place to hold, they also had no pride of place. And this like, oh, holdless people are all inherently messy and disrespectful and they leave their stuff everywhere and they don't take care of their community.
Yeah. There's also interesting. Aramina is aware of the fact that functionally the wagon they travel with is their home. It's not what her parents insist it is, namely a gather wagon that you would bring into the main hold area in order to set up your stall for a gather market day. But she only acknowledges that implicitly when one of the dragon riders very politely refers to it as a gather wagon, and her parents are pleased that someone has recognized it for what it is supposed to be, even if it's not, in fact, what it has been serving as for the past 10 odd 12, 15 years.
Yeah. However old Aramina is, which is a little bit ambiguous.
Yeah.
The question that this poses to me is how much of that disdain is coming from the characters and how much is coming from the narrative.
Yeah.
Because it's very clear that Aramina's parents feel that way, but I'm interested to see whether or not we think the text of the story itself feels that way. We do see Aramina's parents are also very, very resistant to the idea of accepting any kind of charity or not paying for any kind of kindness they receive. And I do think the narrative gently suggests that that's extreme or unnecessary or a little ridiculous.
Yeah, I would agree.
I think some of it is coming from their negative experiences, feeling like they're living on charity in a hold or being judged for taking resources as a holdless or displaced person when they have tried to seek shelter at various holds. So I think that's part of the reason that the narrative is being a little gentle with that. But I also think the narrative does broadly suggest that it's unnecessary and a little contrived, the way they're like, oh, we can't possibly accept medical assistance after a serious injury until we offer them a wooden spoon in trade.
Yeah, I think Aramina's perspective finds it a little bit absurd. Essentially, it seems to me that Aramina is like, under normal circumstances, sure, this is a fine approach to things. Mm-hmm. But in an emergency, this makes no sense. And the fact that my father was trapped under some portion of the weight of their wagon for a while and has like bruising all across his chest, I'm a little bit like, I don't know if he's gonna survive this injury.
Yeah. I don't think that numbweed, which makes you stop feeling pain, and Felis, which makes you sleep, is necessarily going to cure internal bleeding.
Yeah. The story ends at a very weird moment where I'm like, I don't feel like you've resolved actually anything about this situation. But anyway, it seems to me that Aramina thinks it's ridiculous in this context to behave in this way. But it also seems to me that she doesn't really question it. And she does perceive a difference between herself and her family and the other holdless people that they interact with.
Yes.
Not just Thela and her minion, Jiron, who is a man whose dragon died and so left the Weir in order to be away from dragon riders and is described as creepy and soulless in a weird way, considering that the other dragonless character that we've met is Lighthall, who is
very positive.
Certainly dour, but not creepy and soulless, and in fact capable of love and laughter.
I think we are very clearly supposed to empathize with Lighthall and feel bad for him, but also proud that he's rebuilt his life and support his paternal relationship with Jaxum.
Yeah.
We're here, and to be fair, this is very much from Aramina and her family's perspective. It does seem like, dragon died, automatically, guy's gonna be evil and weird, nothing you can do about that.
I'm struggling to escape the implication that he should have just committed suicide rather than living this soulless life, and that there's something weird and creepy about the fact that he is still alive to live this kind of half-life.
Interesting.
I don't think that's borne out by the rest of the series, but it kind of feels like that's what you're telling me here.
It might be specifically that he is seeking power, where Lighthall was very, I must nobly suffer on, and I'm not going to come to the forefront. I'm just going to quietly work in the Weavercraft Hall. And he's placed as the steward of Rothas against his wishes, rather than Jiron, who's seeking power or authority, which might be what is frowned upon narratively. I don't know.
It's hard to know. It's a weird choice.
It's also worth noting that Lighthall is a green rider in Dragonflight and then immediately becomes a brown rider in all subsequent books. And I don't know that we know the color of Jiron's dragon.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason that Lighthall becomes a brown rider has to do with the fact that Dragon Quest begins with a green rider clearly in a sexual relationship with a man, stabbing Fëanor in the shoulder, just at a time when Jaxum is about to start engaging in more adult things. And I think she maybe wanted to avoid the implication that Lighthall might be gay.
Interesting.
Is my read of that retcon. You know, it's McCaffrey, so it's also possible that it was simply a continuity error and she just forgot.
Can never overlook that possibility.
There's also some weirdness geographically in this book. They leave Ruatha and they go west, and they're in Tillic for a while, but when we meet them, they're in Aigen on the opposite side of the continent and going north for some reason to get to
Lemos
in order to get to Ruatha, which is west. So it's a little perplexing as a route, I would say, in ways that the story doesn't comment on as far as I can remember.
Yeah, I sort of assumed that they start at Aigen because we've had in Moretta at least a whole discussion about how there's a lot more holdless people there because the climate is warmer and because there are those big cave systems, and that it's a known, that's where the holdless people tend to collect. So here, they're holdless, they're starting out there. I was like, yeah, that makes sense. I didn't really think about their path across the continent.
Well, I think this ties into some of the broader questions that have come up repeatedly as we've been talking about the series about the political structure of Pern that are, I think, related to the charity question. So over the past few books of the main series, we've gotten increasing reminders that there is a large population of people in the present in the Ninth Pass who are holdless, quote unquote. Sometimes this means younger sons of Lord Holders who who are not going to inherit the hold, and there is less and less land available to subdivide and assign to. And sometimes it means people who have been, for one reason or another, kicked out of their hold, and so are living holdless. And as we find out in Dragon Drums, I think a lot of them do congregate at Eigen because, in addition to the hold, there are a bunch of large natural cave complexes near enough to the hold that people can commute to the hold and work as day laborers, even if they can't actually live in the hold, in formal accommodations at the hold.
Although, if they're so desperate for new holds for new holders, why are those caves available? Why hasn't some younger son snapped that up? Maybe insufficient for their consequence. And I guess there's also, Eigen is more deserty, right?
Yeah.
So there might not be enough arable land to support a permanent population there.
That would be my assumption, that there's some environmental restriction that makes this not viable for a
traditional
formal holding, but does work as, not to be a Marxist on the podcast, but like lumpen proletariat housing.
Be a Marxist on the podcast. Who can stop you?
In order, I think, to understand the charity thing from Aramina's parents, we also have to think about the structure of feudalism. So the way that feudalism works conventionally is there is a lord, and the lord has multiple clients who swear or commit themselves in some way to perform certain obligations for the lord. Could be military service, it could just be providing a certain amount of their crops, it could be doing corvée labor for their lord, something that Jaxum's perspective reflects on. So it's assumed that both parties are getting something out of this relationship, and that this will be a long-term relationship. And I think the fact that Aramina's parents see themselves not as holdless, but as displaced Ruathan smallholders, mm-hmm. is part of why they're so resistant to accepting charity if it comes from someone of higher status, because to them, that reads as committing themselves to a new lord. But what they want is to go back to Ruatha and reestablish themselves there. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to avoid getting themselves into a new lord-client relationship that it would be more difficult for them to get out of.
Right. And in support of that, we do learn that they had previously been ready to go back to Ruatha, and then they had lost their dray beasts in Threadfall. And so they had to go back to, I think, Karun and basically commit her father's labor for a year in order to buy new dray beasts.
Yeah, but that is very explicitly, he's signed a contract for a year of labor, mm-hmm. and the payment is enough money to buy these animals, rather than he's settling into a job in this place. But also it is interesting because the way it's described is he's selling himself as an indentured laborer for a year. He's described, I believe, as a bondsman.
Here, to hire his skill at a hard bargained price for the next term, then trudge his all the way back with the new team to where his family had waited, fearful of marauding holdless men and women and Threadfall. The indenture over, Dowell had once again turned team and wagon westward.
Yeah, so he is in fact an indentured laborer, which we don't actually know a lot about the conditions or the extent of unfree labor on Pern. There's references in Dragon Quest to Lord Grogi's
chattel,
referring to people who are at the hold. This makes it clear that there is a system of indenture that exists, but it's not entirely clear how all of that works. But I must say, I think, as we will talk a lot more about when we get to Dragon's Dawn, all of this follows very naturally from the colonists' original libertarianism. Everyone gets their one hold, but oh no, we're running out of land. So now, as there's less and less land available, more and more people are instead forced into various kinds of either wage labor or unfree labor, mm-hmm. in order to, especially in the context of Pern, survive, because living holdless is very dangerous, especially during a pass, but also even not during a pass. It's a lot safer to have an established place to live.
Two things. One, even in Dragon's Dawn, you have charterers and contractors, where the contractors are literally writing a contract for X years of labor in exchange for X acres of land. So indentured labor is built in from the very beginning, although they don't really see themselves that way. And secondly, I think part of the reason that there's a new focus on the holdless population and that has been a political tension in the Ninth Pass is they're coming off of a long interval. So there's been 400 100 years with no Threadfall, where while it certainly wasn't ideal, you could live holdless in a lot more functional way than you can now that there is random thread. And if you don't have a skill like Aramina's, you really are fully risking your life trying to live holdless.
Yeah, and it's exacerbated by the fact that the Ninth Pass begins with the re-exploration of the southern continent. And now, in addition to this rapid change in the political circumstances, everyone is acutely aware of the fact that there is a whole lot of unclaimed, fertile land down south that is largely protected from Thread. And this will go on to be probably one of the two most significant points of political tension in the remainder of the series.
Yeah.
We should also maybe note that this book is a kind of prequel or companion text or
interquel
test run of The Renegades of Pern, the next main series, not the next, sorry, Dragon's Dawn is next. So Renegades of Pern,
an upcoming main series
book. Yeah, in any case, alludes to the plot of this book, I think possibly retells it from Thella's perspective. So Thella goes on to be one of the main characters and the main antagonist of that book, which I must say, this story and Renegades in ways that we'll talk about when we get there is classic anti-communism. Yeah. Thella is evangelizing among the Holdless and being like, we need to unite and then we can make a place for ourselves.
Share all of our property.
Especially that we need to share things, hold stuff in common, but also Thella is clearly set up as a villain. She's ready to kidnap Aramina. She attempts to kidnap Aramina. She's got this unpleasant dragonless man as her minion. And also, as we discover in Renegades, there's some more complicated political status going on here. Thella turns out to be the sister of Larad, one of the Lord Holders, and her goal is just to amass power for herself and be confirmed as a holder. Mm-hmm. She's mad that Larad was confirmed over her, even though she is, I believe, older than him. And so she tried to get the Lord Holders to confirm her instead, and they refused, so she's bitter about it, ran away, and started this whole plot. So it's a classic, these people have a legitimate grievance against the political system that they're in, and instead of addressing that grievance, we're going to give them a figurehead leader who will use, in this case specifically, the language of communist organizing, except that really she's just there to get power for herself.
And also she wants to threaten children.
And she wants to threaten children. And fundamentally, the whole series has a certain amount of this in that their main adversary is the Red Star, which threatens to destroy the property of our hardworking libertarian feudal landowners. It's such a Cold War series in many ways.
You can tell it was written in the 80s in America.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me how many pieces of American media from that period fall into the same trap. Like Magneto was right. It's clear that a lot of American writers felt like they had to in some way address communism, or that communism was looming narratively and emotionally. Fair. But they also had to demonize it, and they also couldn't come up with a really good way to demonize it. So you fall back on the, and also their leader is just evil or wants to blow up the whole world or murders children, to get you out of actually having to grapple with it in any serious way.
Yeah, because then we can drive Thella away or defeat Thella in some way, and now we've solved the problem, except that we haven't actually addressed any of the underlying material conditions that people were mad about that made them go to Thella.
So picky. Oh my gosh, you want everything to be tied up in a little bow.
I know. Imagine. So speaking of kidnapping and villains.
As in fact we were. Yeah, I came to the end of this short story and I was a little bit perturbed because they're being told, like, wow, you can go back to Ruratha. And Aramina, who's never been there, is like, yes, I'll finally get to see this home that my parents have told me about all my life. And then Lessa's like, no, you're coming to Bend and Weir. And Aramina's like, but I don't want to go to Bend and Weir. I want to stay with my family. And Lessa's like, oh, haha, that's what everyone says. And is this a kidnapping? I kind of think that this is a kidnapping.
Yeah, this is the weirdest search, quote unquote, that we see by a wide margin. So Aramina can talk to all dragons, and the Weirs are always looking out for people because they've found two already. So they'll probably find some more. And that's just in the last 10 years. And lo and behold, here's a third one. So this ability that we thought was rare is in fact very common.
But only when narratively necessary or interesting.
So yeah, as soon as they find out that Aramina can hear all dragons, Lessa and Felara are like, oh, Thella wanted to steal what belongs to the Weir? Before they've even really met her or talked to her, as soon as they find out the situation, they're like, yeah, she belongs to us. Which is
the literal lines, "Of course, Eremina is for Benden Weir," Lessa went on. And then Eremina says, like, "No, I want to go home to Ruatha." And her mom is like, "Well, a girl who hears dragons belongs to the Weir." And then, "It's not as if you can't visit anytime you want to," Lessa said lightly. "I do. The We of Ruatha serve our Weirs whenever we are called to." And then she gets emotionally manipulated by the dragons, being like, "Please come to us. We want to hang out with you." And then Lessa says, "Benden needs a girl who can hear dragons." And Eremina says, "More than my family needs me?" "Far more, as you'll discover," said Lessa, holding her hand out to Eremina. "Coming? I don't have a choice, do I?" But Eremina smiled. "Not when Lessa and Benden's dragons have made up your mind for you," said Falar with a laugh. And I'm like, I'm not laughing, actually.
Yeah, it's troubling.
Clearly it's supposed to be like, oh, haha, reluctant, but it's going to be an adventure. But it doesn't quite achieve that for me.
Yeah. The one thing that I will say is that Aramina's mother, Barla, is like second cousin to Lord Kale, Lessa's father, who was murdered with all of his family except Lessa. Jaxum, the current titular Lord Holder of Ruatha, although it's a little ambiguous when this is set, but I don't think he's been confirmed yet. His mother was like a third cousin, something like that. So it's strikes me that it is also perhaps possible that part of this is to
prevent that from being a political complication.
Right?
Yeah.
Because in the same way that Lessa's son had to be a dragon rider, because otherwise he would have a much stronger blood claim to Ruatha than Jaxum does, you gotta do something to keep Aramina's whole family politically marginalized, or safe on the edges of things.
To be fair, it has been clear before that there's no automatic inheritance.
Oh, yeah.
The Conclave of Lord Holders has to officially convene and confirm you, and it seems like it is less about necessarily a biological relationship than it is about, are you ready? Do you seem like you're going to be good at this? Because Lord Holders frequently have like 10 or 15 kids, and they don't all inherit.
Yes.
I think you could make an argument that even were Eremina and Jaxum and, I don't know, Eremina's mom all presented to the Conclave, they'd be like, yeah, we'd rather have Jaxum.
Oh, absolutely. But I can imagine Lessa in particular thinking ahead and being like, let's just avoid a situation where that happens in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that by essentially, on the one hand, kidnapping Eremina, and on the other hand, bribing her family with like, yeah, we've got all this great stuff for you. Wouldn't it be nice if you just stayed in Lemos? And also we'll take your daughter to the Weir where she'll be a dragon rider. Won't that be fun and good? It's all a little bit like, huh, there's maybe more going on here.
Although, to be fair, I think if that was their concern, her younger brother would probably be more politically important in this context.
Well, yeah, I don't think they would be worried that Eremina is going to.
Yeah.
But I think that having Eremina in the Weir is a convenient way of essentially putting her family in the Weir's debt. Because being a dragon rider is good, and everyone wants to be a dragon rider.
Interesting. I also, complete sidebar, but if Felisan had not impressed, you bet. That Lessa would have been disinheriting Jaxum for him in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. God, and Felisan would have been a terrible Lord Holder.
Terrible. This boy is not good at wielding feudal power. Should anybody wield feudal power? Debatable, but specifically this boy should never do that. I do have to bring up that Eremina instantly recognizes Falar and Fëanor by name on sight. And in this world that does not have YouTube, I gotta be asking, how?
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 And the only answer that we have been provided is that at the Holds, the Harpers teach children the name song, and the name song tells them the names of all of the bronze riders and the Weir Leader and Weir Woman at the Weir that they're beholden to.
But A, Eremina is not beholden to a Weir and has not grown up with any kind of formal Harper education because she's lived on the road, and the places where they've stopped before would not necessarily have been beholden to Benden Weir.
Well, in fact, some of them we know were not.
And B, are you telling me that this song includes a detailed physical description of every single dragon rider, accurate enough that a random 12-year-old is like, that's who that is?
I mean, here's the thing. In Dragonflight, when Falar goes to High Reach's Hold on search, Fax pretends it's implied not to recognize him, not to know his name, and Gemma immediately recognizes him, and Falar's like, he noticed that she had no trouble naming him and his dragon, in a way that implies that perhaps people are in fact taught a detailed physical description of all of the bronze riders at their Weir.
I also love that it's an ongoing plot plot point that the Pernies have struggled desperately to retain technological or cultural history, and they just simply haven't been able to do it. There's too much of it. But we can definitely devote a lot of time and energy to specific physical descriptions of all of the dragon riders.
Yeah, it's... And
heck with calculus.
We got literally, it. Yeah.
Okay, I'm coming up with this on the spot, but in the spirit of trying to defend the world building, what if it's the fact that she knows who their dragons are? She's been eavesdropping in all these dragon conversations, so what if the reason Aramina is so confident about who's Falar and who's Fëanor is she knows, oh, that's Mnemanth, that's Canth.
Maybe. That is the one thing that would make sense. She does kind of know K'van, at least by name, because she knows Heth, his dragon.
Right.
I don't know. I guess I could buy that. And then you could also maybe explain Gemma's thing as someone ran back from Fax meeting Falar outside and was like, it's Falar.
I would also believe that Gemma, who is in a miserable marriage and bored to tears, has more time to memorize the specific appearance of all of the dragon riders. And also at that point, Fëanor is the only Weir.
Yeah.
She's bored. She doesn't have anything else to do with her time.
My one other thought, I guess, about Gemma is that it's possible that she recognizes them because she saw Falon before he died. But that seems a little more dubious because that was a while ago.
Yeah, and that wouldn't necessarily tell her it's Falar and not Fëanor. I guess it's the bronze dragon rider, not the brown dragon rider.
Yeah, anyway, we'll get there when we talk about Master Harper of Pern eventually.
Indeed, to our regret.
So we've talked a little bit about the sudden explosion of people who can coincidentally talk to every dragon. The one last thing that I think I wanted to talk about is the series position of this, and in particular its relationship to all of the romance in the main series. Because this story is about Aramina, but the first dragon rider that she meets and the dragon rider with whom she forms the strongest connection is K'van. We met K'van in The Smallest Dragon Boy, which was published 13 years previously, but...
It seems to take place pretty close because K'van is still a weirling. He's not an adult yet.
Yeah, Aramina can immediately recognize that Heth is undersized, so not fully grown, and that K'van is still short. Looks like The Smallest Dragon Boy.
He has not hit his growth spurt.
Yeah, so I'm interested in the way that these two stories set them up as parallel to each other in a way that suggests, oh yeah, obviously K'van and Aramina are going to end up together. But of course, spoiler alert for Renegades of Pern, they don't, which I think is a fascinating choice. And I wonder why she made that choice, because it kind of seems like the logical follow-up after The Girl Who Heard Dragons.
Actually, it's very clear why that's not the case. Aramina is taller than K'van, and you cannot possibly have a heterosexual relationship in which the woman is taller than the man, or they both instantly die.
That's so true. You're right. I'd forgotten that well-known fact about the universe. Never mind. Problem solved. Mystery resolved.
It's also possible that she was thinking about that and then decided to take Renegades in a different direction.
Yeah, Renegades goes in many different directions.
So few of them good.
It's not a very well-structured book. Anyway, it's just something that I thought was interesting, especially since we're coming off of our episode on Moretta, where there is obviously romance, but it's very much not the kind of standard monogamous heterosexual relationship romance that we've seen in the series thus far. And so it's interesting that here it seems like she's setting that up again, but then we get to Renegades and Aramina still ends up in a long-term monogamous heterosexual relationship, but it swerves away from what seemed like the obvious one.
She's trying to be creative here.
So if you, for some reason, are listening to us talk about this episode and thinking like, I should read The Girl Who Heard Dragons.
Don't.
You should not read The Girl Who Heard Dragons. It's just fundamentally kind of boring.
Yeah.
I would, however, recommend an alternate short story, which is Elaine Kuyag Kang's These Constellations Will Be Yours. If you're interested in stories about a young person being kidnapped into an organization that they are told it's an honor to join, where they are reshaped from the ground up. We're told at the end of Moretta that when you impress, it's like your life begins anew. And also this person has complicated feelings about it and ends up becoming involved in a rebellion against that system. You might like this story. All of Elaine Kuyag Kang's stories that I have read are incredible. This was the first one I read, and it's really good. Published in Strange Horizons. There will be a link on the NeoCities page, and also perhaps on Tumblr.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Dragons Made Me Do It.
If you enjoyed it and want to hear more, you can follow us on Tumblr at dmmdipodcast.tumblr.com for updates or to send us questions or comments. And you can find our archive of episodes, along with transcripts, recommendations, funny memes, and more at dmmdipodcast.neocities.org, NEO Cities.